they're supposed to be. I got an email to set up a recording, so there should be people here at 2:30.
Thank you. well, either people know me or they'll find out the hard way. So, yeah, no, it's no point. Okay, so, yeah, so I try to sort of put some flashy and attracting title for the story. So, you know, I will be explaining, of course, what I am talking, you know, what the subject is about. So let me, first of all, introduce my collaborators. One of them is in the audience, that's Valentin. We came 10 years ago to our place as you know, our contribution to the brain drain for the former Soviet Union. And then there are a number of postdocs and students. Seiji Takagi, who was a postdoc at our institute, who's now a junior faculty at the University of Hokkaido in Japan. She's a young student. She's a young postdoc from Spain. She was a postdoc now in Australia. In Sydney, and so these are a bunch of theorists, and so as usual in this business, you don't get very far if you don't have some solid experimental connection. So we have some contacts with people in the University of Texas Tech University in Lubbock, and Aine Salvadian, and a colleague of her, Arutunyan, and also not mentioned in this transparency. We have an ongoing collaboration with Igor Yefimov from Syracuse Western University from Cleveland, but that may change very soon. Okay, so I don't know. I will say rather elementary things. So, you know, obviously you stop me if it's too boring or if everybody knows all that too well. So, you know, that's... I'm talking about heart and I'm talking about clinics. So, you know, what is the subject? Of course, well, in your chest, there is this wonderful pump whose goal is to pump blood from here all the way to the top and to the toes. And that, of course, requires to generate some good amount of pressure. And that is achieved by essentially, so you have muscle, and there's a way to pump, of course, to contract things very efficiently. So you really want to have all the contractible tissue to go all at once and not start doing other funny things. So the way it's done, it's actually by a combination of an electric circuit, which is very similar in a way to the nervous, you know, to the propagation of nerves. Of action potential along nerves, and that starts that thing triggers the contraction, you know, the mechanistic aspect, which operates essentially on another time scale. So when people have some cardiac problem, what happens essentially is that it is the electric part of the system which is damaged. The mechanical part usually is all right. It's just that it's poorly commanded by the electrical signal. So therefore, the problem that people have to worry about is the problem of electrical things going bad. And the problem is, of course, to avoid or to cure this regime of electrical activity. So that's essentially something that you can explain to anyone. Well, the problem which has a, so what is the problem when it goes bad? Typically, it is our good friend, the spiral wave, sort of essentially when the heart is functioning properly, there's just some waves which invade the heart and make it contract all at once. And when it goes bad, it's very often because instead of having a contraction which happens simultaneously, you start contracting beats. While others are completely out of phase with it. So therefore, the thing will shiver a little bit, and essentially no pumping will be achieved. So the fact that this is related to this complicated and non-trivial dynamics of the electrical regime has been well documented. So there's been a number of papers, and that goes relatively beyond doubt that there is something like that happening in the tissue. Now, So what happens is that in many cases, when you go to see your doctor and you have a problem, well, they'll typically give you a pill. You know, they'll give you some medication, and you'll be all right in some cases. Well, in good cases. Well, of course, so, you know, as I was given this transparency from the cardiac workshop, which is actually an embarrassing story, because of course people have tried in this region of the health sciences. So basically, not knowing what they knew about the heart, they tried to, you know, they know that some chemical does this, some chemical does that. So, you know, they just try to see whether any of that could be helpful. Now, there has been a trial a good decade ago where they essentially tried a class, you know, a number of classes of chemical, and they, you know, as usual, they did the standard test, you know, take 100 patients, give 50 a placebo and 50 the drug. So what happened to everybody's embarrassment is that with one exception, well, one or perhaps two or three exceptions, which reduced the mortality with respect to the placebo, some significantly increased the mortality. So, you know, that one is, you know, it means that people with the placebo had a, you know, a fair chance to, well, had a chance to survive, whereas people with that drug had a good chance to pass away. I'm sorry. Right, but well, the problem, of course, the only problem is that you know, this stuff is a killer. I mean, that's, it's a problem where, you know, there are a number of the people who die, you know, every year in this country and, you know, in all the developing world and actually elsewhere. So, you know, that's not a happy state of affairs. I think probably in conjunction, you know, in some cases you can use them, but you know, you can do that, you know, blindly, you know, so you have, you know, just take that and you'll be around. It's not going to work. So instead, what's being done? I'm sorry. I took. Oh, I see. Oh, just like this drug, we'll just... Yes, that's what I have to say. Oh, yeah.
Oh, I'm
sorry. So, it was a very...
Now it might be... Oh, you need to bring it forward.
So instead, since chemicals, you know, pharmacology seems to be not the optimal way of solving problems, people have other ways, and one of the way, which is the one which seems to be working best so far, is using electric fields. Now, I think in this country, you find defibrillators everywhere, and if you go to the airport, you find defibrillators every 100 meters or so. The way it works, roughly speaking, is that you know, you have your piece of meat, you know, your piece of tissue, and here this little blue green thing is supposed to represent one of these waves which is going around and doing harm, hurting you. And so what you do, you just apply a big shock with a fairly large value. Valentin was giving the values the other day, so, you know, it's typically 10 volt per centimeter at the level of the tissue, a few milliseconds and a few amperes, you know, the equivalent of a few joules being dumped onto your muscle, and by a rather, by a mechanism which is not completely elucidated, it must be admitted, the dangerous regime of wave propagation stops. Now, of course, that's just the most extreme. There are more violent ways to get away with to get rid of the of these waves.
Less violent.
I said more.
Yeah.
Sorry, was a stupidity. Yeah, of course, less. No, that was the one is bad enough. You don't want to get any worse. Yeah. Well, you can kill people. Yeah, that will be also. The problem will go away. There are less violent ways. So, in fact, there's what this transparency here. So, what medical doctors do? If you have one that sort of thing that happens to you in the street, you know, usually there's no defibrillator, and at the end of it, Now, if people know that you can have this sort of problem, what they will do is they will put into your chest an implantable defibrillator, like so, you know, with all this circuitry. And what the thing will do is that it will record, in real time what's happening to your heart. So, here you have a normal electrocardiogram going, so, time is running like that. So, for a while, things are happy and normal. And all of a sudden, you start seeing some disruption of the rhythm. So that's typically 1 second. You beat at 60, you have 60 beats per minute, so it's about a second. And all of a sudden, you see the rhythm that accelerates a lot before essentially you have this sort of noisy-like signal where nothing happens. So typically, what the medical doctors have come up with is that when you start seeing that, you could, of course, use immediately this sort of a huge field. But that's not what they typically do. What they typically do is send a bunch of wave train relatively quick, 5 or 6 wave trains. They wait a little bit. If the problem goes away, they won. Terrific. Now, if it doesn't work, they try again. If it doesn't work, they see what happens. And then if it still doesn't go, then they send a shock. So there's this procedure which is called anti-tachycardia pacing, because defibrillators will be pacing something against what is interpreted here as a tachycardia, i.e. some disruption of the rhythm with still some pumping going on. And if that goes well, of course that's good. If it doesn't go well, they shock.
Can I ask?
Sure.
The sinus is about, you said, a second period.
Yes.
And the tachycardia, let's say,
you have one pacing center, which in principle is giving you this nice thing. The AV node, sinus node and AV node. So this is a combination of these two guys. Now, what I mean by it works or it doesn't work, it means that that sort of a rhythm, which is clearly not induced by the pacing, by the natural pacing, goes away. So, and you restore, and you're back to the usual system. So success means...
Success means that you kill the rapid one, but you don't entrain with the frequency of the pacing.
No. That would be one of the questions I would be addressing, try to see what can happen in that case. But the ultimate thing is, that's what you want. As you can imagine.
Is that different from a pacemaker?
Yes.
Yes.
That's right. So pacemaker is exactly trying to, when you think it's not strong enough or something, then you will tell it to pace every so often. I think along the way you asked, what is the pacing frequency? It's higher, it's a factor of 10 or something. So, you said brrr, which is doing something, but not quite that. Okay, so that sort of depends. If you're asking the people who make these devices, they will tell you 80-90%. Right. The big shock. No, the small one, precisely. So, this procedure I was describing a minute ago will be successful if you talk to the people who make these devices, will work for 80% of the cases. I don't have precise statistics. Take it as some sort of a mean over people. I can't answer this question in great detail. Medical doctors will tend that, in fact, it's more like 70%. So in any case, that is saying that there is a rate of success. It's not tremendous, because when you're forced to do the big shock, the patient is very unpleased. I never had many, but there are people who say that it's like being killed by your horse in the chest. So, it's by all means unpleasant. And in addition, because it's a strong shock, and if things to be implanted, you empty your battery, which is not something very happy. Whereas the other thing is essentially taking very little energy. So you know, you could imagine doing that a lot of time. So essentially, there is this sort of a mixed state of affair where you're sort of happy because it works, but you know, ultimately, if it worked better, no one would complain. In this year? Oh, it's very little. I mean, yeah, compared to the other one, no, it's significant. You know, you just need to sort of put some sort of just about the threshold of excitation, and that's very low. So it doesn't count. Well, you know, that counts. If you do billions of times, of course you'll empty your batteries. But now, so. All right, so with this sort of a broad, well, this picture sort of vaguely described, so what the objective of, you know, the line of research that Valentin and I and the rest are trying to do is basically to try to improve the fundamental understanding of the interaction between cardiac tissue and electric field. That's some sort of an obvious question. The answer is far from obvious. There are a number of tricks there, and I will be trying to show some of them along the way. And so the other thing that you would like to do is to propose ways to improve the, you know, this 70-80%. If you could make it 95% or 99%, that would be, of course, a big help for people who have this sort of problem. So, okay, so I have some sort of a standard presentation. You know, I will, not everything will be weighted evenly. So I think I will go very briefly over the, you know, the standard description of action potential propagation. Then I will be trying to explain how we understand this anti-tachycardia pacing. And then, well, essentially the key words that, you know, so we have spiral waves, and by using sending some wave trains, we manage to move them around, and that could be the solution. Now, then try to sort of think about what can make it fail. So there's a natural candidate, which is when the spiral waves get pinned, and so then the question is become to how to detach spiral waves. And last, if I have a bit of time, actually, which is something which is a little bit not completely in the line of thought that I've been describing, try to describe something about recent experiments of what happens when you have an infarct. So something that you cannot do in vivo, of course, because you don't ask wait until people have an infarct, but you can model that in vitro. And if time permitting, I will be saying a few words about that. Okay, so let me. Okay, so describing this thing. So basically, what I could just do in view of the talks on neurophysiology, I could just sort of get away by saying, well, you know, it's in the heart, you have a membrane which is where you have propagation of action potential. Action potential is just like neuron, and neuron, well, we all know what happens. We have this cable theory, which works very well. So basically, you have this. Your nerves are made by membranes. So that's a membrane which has a capacitance, and all these little animals which will be, you know, this voltage gated ionic currents, which will allow you to exchange ions from inside and outside. So the ions will flow depending on the voltage applied to the membrane. So that's something we have seen several times. And so what people in nerves say is that, that in these things there is some, if you think you just isolate bits of your nerve, they will be coupled electrically by essentially resistances, and that will give you a coupling. So you know, each bit of membrane will talk to its neighbors, and as a result, you end up with this standard diffusion equation type of description. So E will be the membrane potential, which is the difference between the inside and the outside potential. So that there is this capacitance, which will be charged by the ionic current, these guys. plus if you care to inject some current with CPTest, there will be this term here, and everybody will be coupled like that. So I think that's something which surprises no one. Now, of course, that's a very sketchy way of viewing the problem for two reasons. One, which the NERF people also have, that all the voltage-gated ionic currents is a long story. There are zillions of labs around the world which are looking at how these ions work, and you know, there are fundamental progress to make. There was Nobel Prize this year, as Vincent was mentioning, was awarded to people who worked on this, well, on potassium and from the water pump across the membrane. So that's an active field of research, how these things work. And in an organ like a human heart, which is fairly advanced in terms of evolutionary terms, there are basically hundreds of currents. So you know, if you want to be faithful, then you have an ever-growing list of currents which you need to include here. So that, of course, is a mixed blessing, because you don't want, you know, you do not necessarily care about all of them. And you know, it's not practical, it's not feasible, and it may not be even interesting to do that. So then I will just say that there is an easy way to get away, which is just to use this sort of a generic description of the tissue, which is this Fituna Gumo kind of description. Since yesterday, Valentina did the polling and said that, you know, and asked who doesn't know, and everybody responded that they knew. So, you know, I will assume that everybody knows that and not dwell on, you know, if someone is interested, I'll be happy to explain privately. So that is essentially a sort of a cheap way to dispose of the problem. Of course, physiologists laugh at you, and, you know, there are a number of models which are still manageable, tractable, and with which you can play. So that's that is to be saying that the models we are using are either a very simplified model or models which were devised in the early 80s, where people didn't know too much, so they don't have too many currents, and that's all right. You know, that you can be respected enough in physiology department. They won't laugh immediately. You know, they will tell, well, you know, but when you say this current, it means this and that, but that's all. Now, so that's the first, that sort of thing NERF people would have as well. Another aspect which is more specific to the heart is that the scuffling thing, you know, this sort of little resistances that I was laying down in the membrane and saying, well, you know, that's how things get coupled. That is not completely true. And in fact, you have to be slightly careful there. For the moment, I will just say that it is completely okay for describing propagations. And if you just want to see how action propagation goes, this cable description is just fine. When it starts getting fishy is when you start looking at the interaction with an external electric field. So let me, since I'm talking about electric field and its interaction with electric field, which after all is the subject of my talk, let me ask the simplest question. Imagine that you have a piece of muscle, you know, a piece of meat, and you put some external electric field there and just apply cable theory. So what you will find, if you take some small external field, the equation for the membrane potential will be like that. It will just be the linearized Fituna Gumo or other models will give you something like that, which typically implies that the field will return to its resting value. Here it's been taken to be zero with a typical length scale which will be of the order of 1 millimeter. Now, what happens in reality if you have your thing here? What the field will do? It will tend to depolarize one side of the membrane for a length of order 1 millimeter, and hyperpolarize. I drive E toward negative values, more negative values than the resting potential, over a distance of 1 millimeter. Now, that, and by the way, if sort of in the 1970s, because people didn't really have very accurate ways of measuring what was happening, that's everybody was happy with that in terms of experiments. You know, there's this famous, you know, the Weidmann paper in the cardiologist in Switzerland. We essentially observed that without any problem. So that all works with cable theory, that's all happy.
Okay.
Yes.
What do you mean by membrane?
Okay.
I'm talking about cell membrane.
I'm talking about cell membrane. Okay.
That's a completely different scale.
But that's precisely, no, you got it exactly right. You know, because I was very sloppy. I told you there's a membrane around each of my cells. And I was trying to sort of, sweep under the rug the fact that, it's slightly more complicated. So I'm saying that you can get away with that if you don't ask too many nasty questions. Now, if you start asking nasty questions, like the one regarding electric fields, you can get away with that. So nonetheless, the paradoxical situation is that if you think about that, that's what actually triggered some of the work with Valentin, and actually with a number of people, so there's been a number of scholarly disputes about that problem. But if you think about that and ask yourself, how can you defibrillate an organ with a wall of typically one centimeter thick, knowing that the field doesn't seem to be penetrating much deeper than 1 millimeter. That basically, if you think about it, you're in real trouble, because the best it can do is that it will start waves in one case and will do something, but essentially it will, there is no decisive way to see with this picture how the thing will just terminate an action potential and act everywhere in the tissue.
That's an experimental.
That's an experimental picture.
What?
Yeah.
It's
an experimental question, but I also say it was in the 1970s where people were just as smart as we are, but just didn't have as good equipment as we have now. So, that picture has, that experimental picture has its own limitation, because there are things that they couldn't see. But if you think about that picture, which is okay with the cable theory, it has ended the trouble. Okay. Now. Yeah, you have to put all that together. I will return to that and to try to sort of be a little bit less naive about what's going on. Well, ultimately, yes, there's on slow and there's some active element. Yeah, sure. No. That little example is also telling something interesting, because you see, in order to have something non-zero, you have to have some obstacle. You have to have some heterogeneity in the system. Now, this picture is saying that, okay, if I just say to heterogeneity, I get something near the heterogeneity. Now, what happened in reality is that there are many more heterogeneity, which is essentially a Pierre's question. You can just think that they're just heterogeneity of that sort. You have to get deeper, and what you'll discover is that other heterogeneity. And if you take them into account, then the question is which wins, which is important. But then it's in sort of less mysterious. That's a static field. No, fine. All right. So it's just for the purpose of the argument. No, for the sake of the argument. Now, of course, if you put some strong field, and if you put it for a finite time, basically you expect that the same thing will happen. Within cable theory, putting your equation, that you can only do with models, but that would be. Now. Okay, so absolutely, you can say it exactly like that. And when I was saying that these people were having, some equipment which was not precise enough, that just means exactly that. They could just see some coarse grain properties. Now, if you start going sort of further down, you would see something more complicated. That's exactly right.
What's the
Yes. Yes. well, it's a bit. Yeah, that's weird, of course. Yeah. There is not. Sorry, yes. in a sense, I'm saying trivial things. Yes. I'm saying trivial things. Which is all, that's what you're. No, absolutely, absolutely. At this level. Okay, now so that basically sort of I've already sort of flashed some red lights and about a number of things that I will be doing. So let me sort of return to this ATP procedure. And okay, first of all, there is okay. So the problem, as I said, that if things start getting bad. You may just be with a few properly pulses, you may just get rid of the problem. Now, what happens in reality, if you ask this question, of course, you go to your physiologist lab and ask them what happens. Embarrassingly, at the present time, I mean, to the best of my knowledge, no one really knows what happened. So that has not been visualized. So, you know, the best you can do at that stage, maybe it's not so good, but for lack of a better idea, is to try to get some clean picture of what may happen and see how far you can go and what sort of problem you will meet. Now, so the problem, I was saying that basically you send a bunch of pulse and you have on top of it, on your piece of tissue, you have some wave going on, some spiral wave rotor vortex going on. So that's a model problem which is fairly well posed. And which you can do either numerically, so just pick your favorite model and do the exercise, or you can also do what our Russian colleagues did 20 years ago, use the analogy between heart, which is known to be an excitable medium, and other excitable medium, like the Bielousov-Shabatinsky reaction, and try to do the experiment. And so the story, that's an historical picture, which is somewhat hard to read, but time is going A, B, C, D, E, F. So now here you would, it's a bit hard to see, but here you would see that the core of the spiral would be like here, and at some later time, it's being paced from below, and so at some early time it's here, at some later time it's here. So essentially, the happy thing is that the thing, as you pace it, as you send your strain, the thing just moves away, drifts away, and that is a picture of what may happen. Now, that picture is drawn just for the purpose of illustration. I will show other pictures. Now, what is the mechanism underlying this effect? Well, the most simple way of to think about the problem is to sort of trivialize from 2D. Well, now you have waves and things, you can have complicated things, to 1D. When you think about a spiral wave, what it does is eventually it sends, if you sort of look, if I'm at the center of my spiral and sort of look in a radius like that, it will be sending waves at a period which will be the period of the spiral. So the spiral will be turning, and every TS for a period of the spiral, it will be radiating a wave. Now, if I'm from the other side sending a wave train with a frequency which I will call TP for pulse, I guess. Pacing, maybe more intelligent. There will be, I will be sending waves. Now, what happens is that these two waves will collide at some point, so like here. We have these wonderful properties of excitable media that when two waves collide, they will just annihilate, so this guy will go away. Then my waves are, those next wave we will collide will be at this distance, so, and they're essentially moving at the same, in first order as the first, with the same velocity, so they will move, they will collide at the center, annihilate, collide at the center, annihilate, collide at the center, annihilate. So basically what you see immediately is that the period of the pacing is faster than the period of the spiral. Ultimately, you will be able to reach the spiral core and then make it go away. You mentioned, there's a number of problems with this picture, you know, it's a caricature. Yeah, so first of all, you know, this velocity is not quite independent, you may have instability and stuff like that. Yeah, that's true. Yeah. But, in some condition it does work. And I want to see, basically what this thing predicts at some very coarse level is that if you pace at a frequency Tp smaller than Ts, then you will win. Now, so here is a case which is coming from a numerical simulation. So exactly of the same of the same. That's more realistic in a sense. So the Bielak-Jabotinsky spiral was very dense. You know, all these arms were packed together. Now this one is much sparser, and what you see. That's one example of what happens. That you see that after one collision, so you know your front, which was here, certainly moves in this way. Now that actually also points to something. Well, you know, maybe it's a first order correction to the picture I was showing before. It's pretty hard to think of this spiral as just going when it's strongly interacting with the wavefront. It's probably a little bit extreme to say that this spiral will be moving with the period Ts. Clearly, there is some interaction going on, and in fact, when you look carefully at what happens, what you find is that the spiral gets actually to rotate slower because of this process. So when you sort of look in detail about this interaction of waves with this train of with the spiral wave with the train of waves, what you will see in fact is that when the spiral interacts, the frequency of the spiral goes up, and therefore that allows you to beat, in a sense, this limitation which I was giving, which I was saying in the 1D case. That your frequency, the frequency of the pacing should be smaller than the frequency of the spiral. So here I'm larger, okay. Yeah. I'm sorry, sure. Thank you. Okay, I appreciate you. Okay, so here is just a bunch of numerical results with some amusing fit, if you wish. But what you certainly see is that for a moderately sparse spiral, i.e. a spiral which is not, whose arms are not too far from each other, then you start having possibility to have the spiral drift away, even when the spiral has a slower, the bare spiral has a period.
That there are two possible effects. One is that the spiral will drift,
yes.
And the other is that there will be an annihilation.
Oh, I'm sorry.
And in your one-dimensional case, you fix the source,
yes.
And then send things out.
Yes.
But you can also imagine annihilating forces or waves or whatever, and it's not clear to me which.
Okay, I'm sorry. Yeah, okay, very good. No, my analogy, in fact, was a bit incomplete. As you say, I was imagining that my spiral was sitting still and sending its wave. Yeah. And of course, what this previous picture was showing is that it's certainly not going like that. I mean, you know, it drifts.
Amplitude
oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, so that in the physics of these things, essentially the amplitude is untouched. So either it's 0 or 1. It's, you know, it's on and off, if you wish. So, you know, the amplitude here is not, you know, so when these two guys collide, you know, these two forms collide, they, boom, it falls to 0. And for, okay, so there is some funny effect for a while. But essentially, here you get 0. So no, the amplitude is 0, 1. But as Pierre was pointing out, in fact, yeah, sure, the effect, which was not in my 1D picture, is that this thing is drifting, which is exactly what you want, in a sense. You know, I sort of got away by saying, well, I know the strong interaction. By strong interaction, I meant that. But the thing ultimately will be pushed away from your system.
But originally, the S is your spiral arm, right?
Yes.
Why do you call it W? And then later it's W, it's not S anymore, because the S wave runs.
Okay, fine. Because it comes from the first wave which hit, you see. So it was, you know, you're trying to follow in time what happened. So you have S. It hits this W1 front, and you know, so that one essentially gets out of the picture, and you're left with the W1, which will form the new spiral S. You know, S1 will be W1, and S, you see, so there is just this ping pong game.
Next time
you
get W2, and then
correct.
W3, correct.
And ultimately, and you know, ultimately here in this picture, you're going to get out of the game. In that case, that's information that was encoded in this figure. You have the velocity, so dx would be parallel to the field and dy perpendicular. So I'm sorry, yeah. So it was a sloppy, you know, a sloppy explanation. So and that just magnitude of the velocity. So you know, you have a component parallel to the field. You know, my little picture, my two pence picture was suggesting that you know it would be mostly along x. And as you notice, in fact, there is a fairly big Y component. Okay, so that's all good and happy. So, you know, there are lots of amusing exercises you can do with that. Now, one of the motivation I said was that, sometimes it just doesn't work. So, you know, why on earth is it failing and what do you do about that? So now the idea that you know, okay, now it's you know, a Gedanken experiment of sort, you know, because unfortunately we don't have much, as I said, we don't have much of experimental control over that. But it is certainly true that this little picture we were presenting will not work if you start having obstacles. So, you know, there's of course a long line of history in physics where essentially we know that if there are obstacles, we can do things to vortices, sometimes very good things. A Nobel Prize was given about that this year, in a sense. And in our case, it's not good at all. If you do numerical simulation and put in obstacles, some sort of big heterogeneity in your medium, and so what you will see, provided the size of the obstacle is large enough. Now, of course, if it's minuscule, you'll just ignore it. But provided it becomes comparable to the size of your core or larger, then the thing will be strongly attracted, and you will pin your thing. And if you do the game I was describing, it will just not go away. So that's, for better or for worse, the picture we have in mind when we're trying to fight against failed ATP. So basically what I'm going to do, we are going to pretend to assume is that a failed ATP comes from the fact, the existence of obstacles which essentially keep prevent the waves from drifting. Now, it's of course, you may say, how do you know? Well, maybe the argument, the best argument is usually when people have cardiac problems because they have an infarct or things like that. And in fact, it's because their heart has been damaged in one way or another. And typically, these sort of damages are not homogeneous. You don't damage your tissue homogeneously. You typically clog one artery, and then the piece of tissue which was not properly irrigated then gets damaged, and essentially something fishy happens around this place. So assuming that there are obstacles in heart, in diseased hearts is, I would argue, not something completely stupid. I mean, not completely, not obviously wrong. So a minute ago I was saying that a pinning center is bad. Now, what I will be arguing is that in a sense it's bad, but there is a little bit of a, you know, it's not so bad. Well, the fact that there is this obstacle actually might be used to try to get rid of the problem, of this pinning problem. Now, the argument is that if you have an obstacle, so it will certainly attract your spiral, but if you send your electric field, as I was explaining at the beginning, you can generate some local depolarization if I send an electric field. Now, that idea allows us a priori to manipulate the wave and to try to do something to it. So the idea that we're proposing is that sending the pulse will not do, but if you manage to play with your obstacle and play with this possible depolarization near the obstacle, you will be able to do something. So let me first sort of show. So here is an obstacle here, and sort of this the equivalent of this Weidman. Okay, so with all the bad things I said about this sort of model, I'll return to that. So here's my obstacle. I applied an electric field. And so what I was saying, sort of rewritten in some in 2D instead of 1D, is that you will have one side which will be depolarized and one side which will be hyperpolarized. And if the depolarization is large enough, you have the possibility to start away from here. Now, on top of it, you have to think that you have something which is rotating around. And what I will be saying in a minute is that using the depolarization and the possibility to start a wave can be used to unpin the vortex. So how does that work? There are two series of pictures. One is from the FITU model, one is the Biller Rider, so you know, meaning that we are safe on all fronts, either with very simple or more elaborate models. That's not the issue. So here you have your wave, which is happily pinned to this little square here. Here it's pinned. And if you do nothing, it will go around and around. Now, imagine that you apply a field like so, and you start depolarizing that. Okay, so if you depolarize that, essentially you will create a wave which, if there were no spirals, the wave will just move in all directions and expand in all possible directions. Now, the extra bit here is that because the wave has just passed, you have here the wave here will see some tissue which will be refractory. Therefore, it will be difficult for the wave to go in this direction, but it will be easy to go in this direction. So here you see what happens. So at later time, so that bit which which I've not represented, this bubble, this nucleus of action potential, will be able to propagate in this direction and not in that direction. And as the two waves merge here, what you'll do is that you will unpin the wave. That's right. That's exactly right. So you will have a wave which will propagate. Here.
It's distorted by the electric field.
It's created by the electric field.
And also, not distorted in terms of carbon. Not exactly
the
carbon.
No. Well, if you. That's right. Well, okay. By the way, you don't want to let your films turn on forever. So you just create your thing and just you withdraw. So you just put boom and stop it. So you basically have to sort of shock it strongly enough to have it go, and then
you would get a card.
That's right.
And this is the interaction of that
card with the previous one. Exactly. And the game is precisely that thing gets interacting with its refractory tissue, and it won't go in the direction, but will happily go in the direction, and that will be. I'm sorry? No. Okay. Let me comment on that. I will. Okay. So it's the answer is
one thing.
Did I say that? That's ultimately. It was in my transparency? Okay, well, you read very well. Okay, so then, that will depend, the success or failure of this operation. Well, you clearly see that here that there is some, the phase at which I apply my field compared to the phase of rotation is very important because, if I do it wrong, it won't work. So I have to time my phase correctly. Now, so here is some a typical example with this monodomain, et cetera. And in physical units, doing as best as you can. So, and essentially, it's even better than 10, well, 20, it's 10. So essentially, you have from, it's a spiral which must have like 4 or 5 as a rotation period. So what you see is that that thing just jumps down a few milliseconds. Well, it's in phase. It's not in seconds.
In radian?
In radian, yes. Sorry, no, I'm sorry. Yeah, I've converted. I don't remember what I had in my picture. I thought it was time, but no. It's a time divided by the total period. So that's really some phase. So and that's the answer of the question of Chitabra. So if you remember that the integration threshold is 10 volts per centimeters, and if I tell you that I'm about 1 volt per centimeter, so it's much factor of 10 better than the integration threshold, but it's much bigger than the other one. Yeah. So there is essentially. Oh, you just it's arbitrary, as usual, phase.
Well, what does it mean?
Fine. I choose one, I decide by fiat, that would be my time zero. And then.
Oh, it's the electric integrated symmetry.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. That's what you mean.
Now, you also had to pick an obstacle size that was going to have. I mean, this curve
maybe
quantitatively depends on the obstacle size compared to the characteristic size.
Quantitatively, yes.
Is this particularly good?
What does typical data mean? You take your best thing, and if it's a factor of 2, you say it's typical. As a matter of fact, that's really, if I compare it to the other game I will be doing later, in a minute, that's not even the best. You can have anything. That's right. Okay. So now I was telling a lot about sort of the limitations of this monodomain. Now, here is what it looks like. So here is a microscopic view of what the tissue really is. So you see it's done of, just an uneducated eye will immediately say that there are fibers. And if you look more in more details, you will see that in fact these fibers are made up of little bricks, typically sort of rod-like cells, order 100, typically order, well, then it's a very educated eye, typically of order 100 microns in length and 10 microns, roughly speaking, in width. And so that's some sort of an artistic view of what it looks like. So you have this thing. Now, this exercise, if you want to apply a cable theory, you have to apply to every single bit and species of the membrane, and you have to do it right. Of course, so you see that these bricks, as I'm calling them, are connected, there's electric current may go through, from one to the other, and that happens through little pores that just punch holes in the membrane and connect them together. That's called gap junction in jargon. So essentially, in principle, you have to do all that. Now, if you do all that, there is a formalism that allows you to do all that. That's called homogenization theory. And what you end up with, I'm not going to get into the details of how you go from all this complicated mess to this model, is what people call the bi-domain model, which is, again, some coarse-grained model. You don't go into every single detail, but you average over 10 cells or so. And so what you have to say is that, the picture you end up with is to say that, you have some current that flows outside the exterior of the cell. There's some current that flows inside the cell. And so of course, there's a current, there's potential. And so, of course, there's this ionic current which sort of goes in and out of the cells. And so what you write is that there's this Holmes, so you basically write just Holmes' law as usual. So you introduce some potential. You just write that I is related to the potential by a conductivity tensor, a sigma E. At the exterior, at the interior, you will write the same thing. And these quantities are available for you to measure. And what you find is essentially that these tensors are, as you could guess, very anisotropic. Namely that going along the fibers and perpendicular to the fiber is not the same thing. And in addition, what you find is that the anisotropy ratios are not the same. It's not quite that the extracellular anisotropy tensor there is no anisotropy extracellular. There is a bit of anisotropy, but there's less than inside. So essentially that makes the game slightly more complicated, but that's what seems to describe well a number of effects. By that, I mean that people didn't invent that just for the fun of it. This model was essentially invented because if you looked at some elementary experiment of cardiac field electric field interaction, the monodomain, the simple cable theory miserably failed. Now this one actually does a much better job in predicting correctly predicting what happens if you have a piece of cardiac tissue and if you inject a current. So you just put, you just send a pulse of extracellular current. If you're in monodomain, you would say everything will be hyper or depolarized, who knows, but it should be homogeneous, isotropic, not quite isotropic. You should find some non-homogeneous propagation. And in fact, what happened is very different, and the bi-domain model captures that. So I will not go into what the bi-domain does in this case. I will just say what it does in our case. So remember, the picture I was having before was that I was having my hole and I was sending my electric field and I was having this plus minus little thing. Now, what happens when with this bi-domain model is the new phenomenon you have is that instead of this plus minus, it's of a dipolar kind of field. What you have is you have a six-fold, well, you have some trace of the six-fold symmetry. So let me show you a more. So here is a result. I mean, we hope someone will do it relatively quickly. But here is a result, for what people would do if they had some, photosensitive diet and everything. So the field is applied, and so you depolarize that side, hyperpolarize that, and you see some depolarization here and here, and hyperpolarization here and there. How does that work? Why is it so? So that absolutely. If I do some little calculation, or if I set up some little calculation, it will be clear what happened. Now, how do you understand that? The idea is that we know one case very well, which is the case monodomain, and what happens is that the monodomain is the same as a bidomain model with equal anisotropy ratio. So you just fiddle with your equation and you end up with that. So what you can do is try to go from full steam, realistic values by domain model from a monodomain and then by perturbation, so to say. So that's, in fact, the procedure that we all do that routinely, right? So essentially, what we start with is from the case where there are two, the anisotropy ratio from the inside and from the outside, external and internal, are the same. And in fact, to be even simpler, I will just begin with just saying that the two are equal. And then I will just perturb. Just take this as a perturbation. Now, so if you do that, of course, at zeroth order, you will find, flashing a few equations. Don't get put off, I think it's unnecessarily complicated and can be said relatively simple, but just to pretend that I can do calculation. So at zeroth order, what you find is exactly the same kind of Helmholtz equation as you had. So that's exactly the same. So the zeroth order is the same. And of course, you can solve for, here I'm solving for the membrane potential. There's also the external potential, which you can also solve. And you find some sort of dipolar kind of term, which again shouldn't be any surprise. If you have just some sort of a field, you essentially get a dipolar term. Now, if you sort of crank one at the next order, what you will find is an equation for the first order correction, the membrane potential. So there's going to be an epsilon phi m1 coming up. So there will be the same equation as before, as it happens time and again in perturbation expansions, time the source term. And this source term is essentially a D term, L equal 2 term, in terms of, if you're thinking of it in terms of the spectral, of the Fourier decomposition. So essentially what you have at first order, it was you were just having this first order, L equal 1 term, this cosine term, and that term is essentially a cosine 2 theta term. So essentially what when you combine these two terms, you will have one cosine theta term and one cosine 3 theta term. So that's essentially how you get the structure of that stuff. Now, I could have said that in a much simpler way. Essentially, if I have something which has this fast propagation and slow propagation, you see immediately that the operator of propagation will essentially have L equal to, it will have a cosine 2m, cosine 2 theta dependence. So if you try to solve this elliptic equation, which has cosine theta, which has the homogeneous term plus the cosine m theta, 2 theta, and if you beat that with the cosine theta, which comes to the field,